Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours.
All right, so happiness is like a cat, right? Like if you want a cat to come over and lay on your lap, There's a couple ways you could approach it. You go over, pick up the cat, set it on your lap, and what's the cat going to do? It's going to stand up and walk away, right? It's offended at your repugnance to go grab it, you know, like that, right? Because that's the nature of a cat, right? But if you want the cat to come down, what you have to do is you have to create an inviting lap, right? And then you can't get rid of that damn cat if you tried, okay? And so that's the nature of happiness. You have to set up the context from which happiness can exist. You can't overtly go create it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Executives After Hours. That was Todd Tresider. He is a wealth coach. You can find out more about him at financialmentor.com. He's written a ton of books. He does courses. And what I love about Todd is he just makes finance easy peasy. I don't know about you, but for me, you know, we talk about in the podcast, I just don't understand the language of it. It's just such a complicated topic for me, ironically, on many levels. But anyhow, so today on the show is Todd Tresider, financialmentor.com. Check him out. Wealth coach. He's a great guy. We have a great story to tell. And we just shot the shit for pretty much the whole time, but it was fun. So anyhow, all right. This is a short intro today because Todd's little snippet was long. So go to my website, www.drjameskelly.com. Check out my vlog and blog. If you haven't seen me on Thrive Global, Ariana Huffington's website, go search me there. My articles are posted there as well. So, all right. Have a great week, everyone. Crucible's Gift, April 23rd. Well, and just, you know, for my audience to know, and I'm looking at it right now. You've got how much money do I need to retire? You've got 4% rule. Don't hire the financial coach. Variable annuity pros and cons, that's way out of my pay grade. And investment fraud are the books you have. And you have another book, right? I think you said you're working on. And these are all on Amazon. Go ahead.
Yeah, the book is in. Yeah, it is. Thank you. And the book, it's coming out probably within a month or two. It's in final edit stage now. We're just finishing the final content that we go to line edits is leverage, which is how to make more by doing less. And so, it's all about how do you apply leverage within your wealth plan.
And so this is, I mean, for me, you know, this is a really interesting topic that I feel like it's and I'm sure you get this from many people, and it's daunting. The language is daunting. The content is daunting. The lack of knowledge is daunting. The whole process of understanding finance is really complicated to me. You know, my wife and I were having this conversation today that I wish I had the confidence to know that I could read this stuff and understand it in a way that I could apply it.
You absolutely could.
It just feels so complex.
It's not. You know what happens is you've got all these guys that make it sound complex. I'm actually known for taking high level complex financial subjects and simplifying and making them understandable. That's actually what my reputation is. This stuff is not that complex. I mean, you can hear me talking. I sound like a California surfer dude, you know, but yeah, it's really funny. Cause like I did an article on the 4% rule, which is kind of an academic research thing about safe withdrawal rates and retirement and stuff. And I did a piece on it. And I got an academic research journal contacted me and asked if they could republish it in their research journal because it was so detailed and so involved. And yet it was published on my blog, right? Mm-hmm. And the guy, I was talking to the guy, you know, that runs the research journal. And it's pretty funny, right? Because there's five pieces in this research journal. And, you know, after each author, there's this long list of acronyms, you know, they're the PhD, blah, 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 blah. And they've got this long list of acronyms and then it's Todd Tresider, financial coach, right? and the guy talked to, you know, after he did the article and he's like, I just cannot believe you produced this thing. And he goes, who are you? Like, where did this come from? And I said, this is just my field of expertise. And he goes, you're not an academic. You have never. And I go, no. goes, wow, that's amazing. And it's, this stuff is, when you understand it, you have to wrap your head around it. It takes a little bit of doing, but it's totally within your reach. It's, and anybody that makes it complex is doing it a disservice, you know, where they throw a lot of jargon. There's a certain amount of language you have to master. Like, you notice I just said 4% rule and safe withdrawal rates, right? Those are like technical jargon terms, but you know, you have to label it correctly. So, you know, it's like Albert Einstein said, you want to make it as simple as possible, but no simpler. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I do is I take this stuff. It's really not complex. I mean, anybody with basic high school or algebra background can do this stuff. It's, you know, cause wealth is math. Yeah. At the core of wealth, everything's driven by math. It's all, you know, you can understand it as a basis of equations that gives you your frameworks or structures, but beyond that, it's very simple. I mean, it's almost common sense.
So how did you get into this? Like what about this topic gets you up in the morning?
I was fascinated by money machines. You know, like the idea, what got me in it. So I started in the hedge fund business. We haven't really backtracked and given my background or anything.
We'll get there. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, I started in the hedge fund business. We'll get there right now.
Yeah.
And so what happened, and this is before it was called hedge funds. They were just private placement partnerships. I knew I didn't want to become a financial advisor because I knew enough about the business, even as a college kid, that financial advisors really are salespeople. Right. And it's just the product they sell. Like some salespeople sell used cars. Well, these guys sell used stocks and bonds. Right. And so that's their product that they sell, but their profession is sales. And it, you know, this is not a controversial topic. This is well known. If you look at the training for financial advisors and brokers, it's always sales training. Mm-hmm. And so it's not investment management training. I want to be an investment manager. And so I went straight to the hedge fund business back when it wasn't even called that. I wanted to get into the investment management side. So anyway, that's what got me into it was in my mind, it was about how do you make money with money? Consistently, reliably, how do you create a money machine? And that's kind of what fascinates me with internet marketing too. Like my pattern has always been that, right?
But we got to back up because I'm confused. So what is it about money making money that interests you? Like where did that start? Did that start when you were in high school? I mean, the research that I was doing on you, you know, it seemed that you've always had this interest in creating wealth. So does this derive from your parents? Is this derived from?
Well, it derives from scarcity. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, right? I had to live, you know, watching every nickel and every dime to get through college. I worked my way through college. You know, I had paper routes as a kid and, you know, I mean, I wasn't born with a silver spoon. I mean, I came out of college in debt with student loans after working my way through. And I value freedom. I have a high value in freedom. And so I made some mistakes like everybody else makes, you know, like a lot of people confuse financial freedom with personal freedom. That was a mistake I made as well.
What does that mean? What's the difference?
Well, you can be free without being financially free, right? But, you know, in my child mind, I kept seeing the limitations imposed on me by not having money. I kept seeing like, you know, when I was in college, my friends would go off and tour Europe in the summer. They'd get backpacks and, you know, my fraternity brothers would go off and tour Europe. Well, I would dig steam trenches at the university to make enough money to get back into school the next year.
Because you went to UC Davis, correct?
Yeah, my degree is from UC Davis. I finished up at UCLA. But okay. Yeah, and that's so I was digging steam trenches for the university as a summer job to pay the bills. You know, and then like when I was in the fraternity, right, the guys would go out drinking at night at the bars or whatever, and I wouldn't go because I didn't have the money to go buy drinks, you know, or like we'd be studying at night and people would go to the coffee house on campus to go get a snack and a cup of coffee. I wouldn't go because I didn't have the cash. You know, I went an entire quarter. One summer, I built a pool supply business. And as an entrepreneurial venture, I had this kind of interesting idea, which we can go into if you want, but it's kind of a sideline anyway. And it made money, decent money for starting and ending all in one summer. I mean, it was an impossibly crazy idea but it came out but I didn't have a lot of money to get through school the next year. And so I went an entire quarter on a budget of $100 and I had money left over.
Oof. I was a broke college student as well, so I can appreciate that. I had to work all through college. You talked about having a paper route when you were a child, and there's something in that. I've interviewed a lot of people, and that was one of their first jobs, so many of them, and then uber successful. What was it about having to work so young that you think had an impact? Was it parentally given, like you have to work, or was it I want something to buy something, so I need to work?
No. I was the freak in my family. There's no other entrepreneurs in my family. They're all good people, and they hold down regular jobs. There's no slight here at all. It's just that, I was the one that was always kind of the crazy one that had crazy business ideas and, you know, did different adventures and stuff. So, I think it was just, you know, seeing the reward from your work effort. Seeing that if you put out the work effort and you did it smart, that you would get a reward, and that reward resulted in benefits to your life.
Did your parents teach you that, or was it just literally intrinsically built into you?
I guess it was intrinsic. No, it wasn't taught. Like I said, I did not come from entrepreneurial background at all. I created it.
Yeah, but so you don't have to be taught work ethic from an entrepreneurial standpoint, but were your parents hard workers overall, whatever job they did?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My dad would, you know, he was very reliable, went to work each day, but he held he was an engineer and, you know, held an engineering job. But I always tell the story. One of the things that drove me as an entrepreneur was we would go pick up my dad at the BART station. If you don't know what BART is, it's the Bay Area Rapid Transit. It's like the subway system, but it's above ground for the San Francisco Bay Area. Right. Yes. So it's a commuter train. And so every day we would go down in the station wagon with the dog and my mom and pick my dad up from the train station or the BART station. And I remember sitting there, and every day the same people got off the same train at the exact same time, wearing the same suit with the same shoes and the same white shirt. And the only thing that varied every day was the tie. And I remember sitting there thinking, if this is as good as life gets, shoot me now. Like it was so suffocating to watch day after day. I just said, my life has to be something different than this. Hmm. You know, those are the words of an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah. No, I think that's really, really impactful thought process, because I remember thinking, you know, my mom would come home every day and my dad wouldn't even talk about his job, but my mom would complain about her job. And all I ever thought is, man, I don't want to work in the real world. Like, it sounds miserable to me. No one's ever happy.
Yeah. And I can remember I came out of college, and one of my first jobs out of college, I was working for Hewlett Packard. They had these different local sales divisions. So I was working in a sales division area. And I remember they had this policy. First of all, I can remember commuting to work in the San Francisco Bay Area and oh my God. I mean, I just felt like this is the worst thing ever. I can't believe it. You know, I'd be at a Grateful Dead show in the evening, and then the next morning I'm commuting and people are in traffic putting on makeup in the car and shaving while driving to work, and they've all got their suits on. And I'm like, this sounds pretty close to hell to me, you know, like this is just miserable. And then I remember again, these are just observations that tells like really what's inside a person's soul. I remember one of those girls that I worked with, she got a brand new BMW. It was a BMW 320i, brand new. And, you know, we were working in the same area, so she wasn't making any more than I was or comparable. And I looked at that car, and everybody goes out, like the entire office goes out and ogles over and congratulates her and all this stuff. And I'm looking at it thinking, you idiot, like you just enslaved yourself to this company for the next X years to make the payments on this depreciating asset. Like, could you get any stupider, right? Now, of course, I kept those thoughts to myself, but I mean, that was my reaction while everybody else is ogling over this beautiful new BMW thinking it looks cool. And I'm like, my God, this is a rite of passage to poverty. What are you thinking? This is enslavement.
And so I was, you know, when I was doing research on you, and your website goes into this quite a lot, talking about your journey and your thoughts around that's stuff, and you want experiences.
And so
you like the outdoors, like to be outdoors. So, you know, my brother-in-law doesn't buy nice clothes, but he buys his fun stuff. Like he buys his bikes and his whatever. So what do you spend your money on for the fun stuff? What gets you going that way?
Well, travel and adventures with the family now. It used to be like when I was single, it was toys, just like you're describing with your brother, right? Yeah. So I always had the latest, coolest mountain bikes, road bikes, ski equipment. And you know what's funny is it doesn't cost that much, right? Like you can buy the toys. Once you got the toys, it's just time and health to enjoy them.
Yeah.
And then once I had kids, I wasn't buying myself toys anymore. And fortunately, they were really good quality toys. So they've lasted me a long time while raising the kids. And now it's adventures with the kids. So like, we went and did 2 months through Europe where we did city first. We were in Paris for a couple weeks and then we hiked 500 miles across Spain. So we start in France and cross the Pyrenees and then go across the entire top of Spain. It's called the Camino de Santiago. You know what it is. Okay. Yeah. So it's like, it's an old pilgrimage route, but it has, you know, it's like thousands of years old. It's an ancient trail that winds all through the Spanish countryside and ends up out by the coast. And it's absolutely gorgeous. What an amazing family experience. We hiked this thing for a month. Right. And then after that hike, then we bombed on down to Portugal and hung out at the beach for a couple of weeks before coming home.
Where did you go?
Oh God, I don't even remember. They're little tiny beach towns down on the Portugal. My wife would remember. She booked it. I just show up.
So last summer we spent 6 weeks in Portugal on the beach.
Awesome.
Yeah, we were in Peniche, so just north of Lisbon, about 45 minutes on the beach for 6 weeks. Well, this is where I wrote my book.
we were south.
Okay.
We were south.
That's beautiful Lisbon. Down there.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. It was gorgeous. Cute. It's this beautiful blend of tourism with the ancient fishing culture, right?
Totally.
Like the tourists haven't quite pushed the ancient fishing culture out. Like all the boats are on the beach and they mingle like almost effortlessly with the tourists, right? So like the breakfast place, you sit down and you're sitting down and the table next to you is the fishermen that have lived there for generations sitting at the table next to you while you're sitting there having breakfast.
And the fish is amazing. So, I mean,
that's an example. Yeah. Or like I did I'm getting into these long distance hikes. I call them walking meditation. So I also did the John Muir Trail, which is 250 miles. It goes from the base of Yosemite to the peak of Mount Whitney and along the Sierra Nevadas. And so that was, you know, I'm just really getting into these long distance hikes and long distance bike rides too. I enjoy that.
Are you going to do the Appalachian Trail then?
I don't know if I'm going to, the AT. I don't know if I'm going to do that one or not. I kind of do them as it works for family adventures or, you know, so I'm just kind of doing one at a time and we'll see where it goes. It's not really like some big goal. I just enjoy doing them.
So let's talk about this idea of experiences. You know, this defines you, right? This is what makes you different than probably many other financial advisors. You know, it's funny. I just talked to a financial advisor. I'm on this financial streak right now, apparently, for my podcast. Scott Allen Turner.
Texas. I know Scott.
Yeah. And he's similar to you. Like, he doesn't want all the crap. He wants all the experiences. And that
he plays guitar.
Yeah. So Scott was on last week on my show, and it sounds like to you there's this idea of having experiences, and I have kind of a theory, but I want to hear it from you. Why do you think these experiences are more important than the things? And do you think that you've always had this sense of wanting experiences over things?
No. First of all, no, I did not always have the idea of having experiences over things. What happens is when you attain financial independence, it becomes painfully obvious. Because when you can buy anything, when I say anything, I'm saying within reason, right? Like I can't go buy a yacht that you park in, Monaco or something like that. But when you can buy pretty much anything you want, what you find remarkably is you don't really want anything. That what you want is a quality life. And all the things it means to quality life. And so many of these things are going to sound like cliches saying this, right? Because it really does. It sounds like a cliche because it's wisdom that's been passed on forever. So it's not like some big secret. Mm-hmm. But when you actually experience it, it becomes obvious that it really is the way it works. The reason we want so much stuff is because there's a scarcity mentality that makes it appear alluring. Right. But when you have abundance, when you can actually have all that stuff, you actually don't care. You don't want any of it because it's just, it all takes energy. It all takes time. It all sucks away from your life. And you start looking at, well, what really makes you happy? And it's friends, experiences, adventures, family, health, you know, like all these really basic things, love, you know, it's just stuff that it doesn't even resonate on the podcast. And yet that is really what it's all about.
You know, I always found that, and that's lovely. Thank you, because I agree 100%. Like I'm not financially independent, but I live by experiences. So, I would sacrifice buying something to have an experience any day of the week. You know, that's just kind of in my blood. And for me, the reason why I think I value them so much is I didn't have any as a child. We didn't take vacations. We were poor, lower middle class family. We didn't do anything. Like there was, I didn't experience anything. So I feel as if at this point in my life, I'm really trying to make up for that with my family. You know, this summer are flying. I don't know if you know this or not. I live in the Middle East right now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I live just outside Dubai. And so cool. This summer we're flying to Philadelphia, which is where we moved from when we moved out here. And we're hopping into a minivan, and we are driving from Philadelphia all the way across the country to Yellowstone, up to Glacier National Park, over to Seattle, down through Portland, which is where my mom is at, down to SFO to see Mary's brother. And then we're flying out of SFO like 45, 50 days later.
Yeah, my stomping grounds.
Yeah. I actually used to live in San Jose. I spent about 8 months there. I got fired from my second job. So I got fired.
But I mean, even when you talk about Yellowstone and Glacier, those are my stomping grounds, right? We have a small motor home. It's not huge. It's just a small one. It's 22 feet long. And one of our favorite things is going camping in national parks.
That's awesome.
I mean, it's some of the most beautiful scenery. We love hiking. You can't beat it. And then the nice thing about camping, we love it, is, you know, you bring your own food, you eat healthy food, you know, you're not eating in restaurants every night. And it's just low hassle, totally enjoyable, great scenery. You can't beat it.
And so going back to the experience thing, do you have any inkling of you inside you? I'm trying to force the narrative here, I think. You're probably going to tell me I'm wrong. About, like, were you as a child able to go have lots of experiences to have that experience in sense, not to sound redundant?
I wasn't deprived childhood or anything like that. I mean, we had middle-class childhood and you know, there's no big story in the childhood part. Yeah. But was it the adventure that I wanted to live as a child? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely had more adventure inside of me than my family ever lived. Like I said, I was the freak in the family. I was the adventurous one. I guess there was some deprivation sense in there, but I can't really blame it on the family. They were just a normal family and I was an unusually adventurous kid. Mm-hmm.
So where's been the favorite, like your favorite place that you've been able to go to now that you've attained your financial freedom?
Wow. It's funny. When you asked me my favorite place, the thought came up Chamonix, France. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is, because it is one of my favorite places. I think it's absolutely amazing how you can ride those trams up, you know, thousands of feet and then start hiking from there. And it's just gorgeous and it's French. So it's kind of fun. And, is it really a favorite place? You know, it's funny when you interview me, James, you're going to see that I'm not an absolutist.
Yeah.
So like things like, what's your top tip or what is your favorite, you know, all those little like soundbite questions.
Same. I hate those. Is the word. I'm well, worse. Yeah. There's no absolute for me. There's lots of gray.
Yeah. Everything's shades of gray. So like, you know, what's one of my favorite, I love national parks. I was just telling you, I love national parks and camping, but then you asked me my favorite place and the thought that immediately came to me was Chamonix, France. But then like, if I really think about it, I go, is that really my favorite place? Not really. I mean, Paris is cool, but then I really enjoy all kinds of other places too. It's not just French places. It's, you know, I love New York. We go to New York. I love New York. I love San Francisco. I love Portland. I mean, there's beauty in all kinds of places and they're all different. So I don't know. I just don't, I don't respond well to the absolute thing. Like my mind just, honestly, my mind doesn't think that way.
I'm the same. And I think that's a fair statement. I was thinking, as you were saying that, I was thinking if you were asking me the same question, I don't know if I'd have a favorite place, because I think that every place has a moment in a context that has meaning to it. And so to pick something that's the absolute best, you know, for me, Portugal was amazing because I accomplished a book while I was there. Or for me, going to the Great Barrier Reef was amazing because that's something I wanted to see. Was it my favorite place ever? No, because Ningaloo Reef on the other side of Australia is equally as beautiful, right? And I did it. So like, yeah, I totally agree with you about this absolutism. And I always feel like the more experience you have in life, the harder it is to pick absolutes.
Ah, that's good. I like that. I think that's really true.
When I talk to someone who's very black and white, I think I'm a bit snobbery this way, not on purpose. I don't know if snobbery is the right word. And I don't know if you agree with this or not, but that individuals who haven't traveled or experienced things, I personally have a harder time relating to, because they become very black and white. And I think, well, no, because of this or because of that. And for me, travel and experiences opens the window to opportunity to learn something that you never thought you could once learn, you know? And
I think this black and white is an interesting subject, because what it does is it, you know, the parallel to that is oversimplification. You know, like in interviews, if it's a, like you're running a long format interview and we can explore topics and dive deep, right? But often in interviews, you're supposed to soundbite things super quick, you know, and that's where you get a lot of these absolutist questions. And what happens is people want simplicity. They want black and white. They want answers handed to them. And when you go into the complexity of new, like you hit earlier on, traffic for websites is nuanced. And I jumped right on. I go, yeah, you're right. That's how it works. And there's ideas in wealth planning that are nuanced. And there's complexity around going into it that people don't respond to. They want it really simple. Like they want it, they want investing to be one sentence, you know, buy, hold low cost passive index funds, diversified portfolio, low cost passive index funds, bam, you know, and like, that's supposed to be everything you're supposed to know about investing. No, it doesn't work that way, guys. I'm sorry. There's a lot more than that. People put their whole careers into this and they still fail miserably. If you really think it's that simple, but that's how people want to portray it. Right. Or like they'll say, get your site ranking. It's all about backlinks. No, it's not. It's nuanced. There's quite a bit of subtlety to it. Same thing. I mean, you go any subject. What I like to talk about is there's kind of two levels of understanding. There's level one, which tends to have simplistic solutions, which is what we're addressing here. And then there's level two, which is this nuanced dynamic reality in it, that that's the way things actually work, but you have to put some effort to learn it.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you 100%. And I think that that's the second level is the harder one.
And yet it's the rewarding one. Mm-hmm. See, and I'm driven towards that second level. Like I'm fascinated by stuff to go find that second level and to explore it and learn it. Whereas a lot of people, they just want the simplicity, you know, it's not right, wrong, but in a way it is.
Hey, so I was just thinking about this. I meant to ask this question when we first started. So this is totally random. So just acknowledge this ahead of time. My wife and I last night were having this debate. And I want to know, I told her I was going to ask my next guest this question to see what you say.
I'm put in the middle of a family debate.
So
spousal debate.
No, this is about clipping toenails. This is fingernail toenail clipping. So she thinks, so I clip my toenails or fingernails in the sink. She's like, that's disgusting. I'm like, you wash them down the sink. Who cares? That's not a big deal. You know, or the trash can, but, you know, sink or trash can. She does hers on the floor and then may or may not sweep them up later. And I said, that's way more disgusting than the sink. Like way more disgusting. She's like, no. She's kind of a clean freak, which is why this blows my mind. And I'm kind of a dirty guy, which blows her mind that I think that's disgusting. So it goes both ways. And I said, there's no way that anyone on this planet thinks that putting your fingernails or toenails on the floor is acceptable behavior. And then you walk away from them. And I said, I bet the next guest I talk to will agree with me 100%. So tell me.
Well, yeah, it just happens. I do what you do. But so we'll take one level. If here's the punchline to what you're saying. If they're not getting cleaned up, then yeah, it's a problem.
Yes.
Right. It's one thing if you put them out on the floor and you clean it all up, then whatever. If it goes on the floor, it goes in the sink. Who cares as long as you clean it up?
Yeah.
But here's, as long as we're going to get really disgusting here.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. You can't wash them down the sink because then they embed in the stuff in the trap. And over time you tend to clog your sink. So
that was her excuse.
You actually have to close the trap or the plug and then pull them out and flush them so that you don't clog the thing. Now we've really gone downhill. Okay.
We've gone down the sink.
Yeah. We've gone down the drain on this one.
Well, I just want to say that was her point as well, why she thought that was wrong. So
yeah. So you have to pull them out. Yeah,
nuance.
So use the sink to catch them, but then you gotta get them out. But then the sink's easy to clean afterward.
Yeah,
you just kind of wash what remains down. But Okay. So James, you got a first for me. I've never been asked about toenails. I've done 200 100 interviews, never been asked about toenails. You won. Awesome. That was the weirdest question ever.
It was more of like a comment of looking for affirmation that I was right. And what you did is provided more nuance. So
it's got, okay. Well, you both get to be right because you can't wash them down the sink either, but you got to clean them up off the floor. They both are bad.
So I was thinking, so like how long, you know, we're talking about wives, like how long have you been married?
Oh, wow. You're going to get me in trouble here.
I'm going to go with like 25 years.
What's that?
25 years.
Oh, you're telling me?
I'm guessing. I don't know.
We got married in 98.
Okay, so not 25 years. All right. So you're
It's 20 years.
Yeah,
20 plus years.
All right. And you have, so how did you, I'm just curious, like with you and your wife, do you have those what's the word I'm looking for? Those type of debates that I just described, like toenail debates.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Come on. You're not going to live with a spouse for 20 years and not have crazy discussion. We have resolved like, you know, toilet seat up or down. We have resolved like which direction the toilet paper runs. Does it go over the top or underneath?
Never had that like, one.
Yeah. So we've got the basics resolved. Yeah. You know, we agreed to eat healthy. I mean, the basics are down.
So wait, how did the conversation go from a financial standpoint when your wife marries you? Were you pretty much like, I'm handling the money and that's it? Or, you know,
well, actually it's a little bit more, it's nuanced, right? That's the word of the interview there. So I run the big picture finance. So I run all our investing and I'm building the business. So generate the income, but she runs the household finances. And there's a reason for that too, is that I have to focus on the big decisions that really make a difference. I am frugal by nature. That's how I built my wealth in the first place, was being a value-oriented consumer. And I will do really stupid things. Like I will sit there and price shop a can of tuna. Now that doesn't make any difference in our lives. It will never change anything. It's a complete waste of my time. And so we just insulate me from it, right? We just don't. So I don't do any of our personal spending, and it's perfect too, because I actually don't enjoy any of it. Like
it hurts you mentally.
Yeah. Like if you said, Todd, you need new clothes, we got to go clothes shopping. It's like, it's like pulling toenails off of me. Let's go back to toenails again. It's like pulling my toenails out because, I just don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy going shopping. I don't enjoy buying stuff. Like when we had to go buy a car, right? Well, here's the gift that makes car shopping for us easy, is that, I'm 6'4" and long legged in 6'4". So the number of cars I actually can fit in comfortably is pretty small. And so we can go through about 5 dealerships of cars in a few hours, because I just walk in each car, sit down. Nope. We'll narrow it down. There'll be like 3 or 4 cars that I fit in and we'll go, okay, well, this one will work. This fits our needs. Bam, done, bought.
Yeah. Well, you must love car shopping now though, because it's so transparent online in terms of what you can get and not get.
Well, and again, I'm just not a consumer. I just don't get huge value from it. So like, we own Toyotas and Hondas and Subarus, and they're known for their reputation for durability, their efficient price points, and their quality cars. To me, it's a car. I drive it. I go somewhere. I want reliable transportation. I just don't care.
So I love the fact, by the way, that that. So let me ask you. That's what's actually my question. And we talked about saying you're a value shopper. What line is value impact quality for you?
It's an interesting question, because this is something people confuse a lot. A lot of people confuse cheap with value, and it's not. As a matter of fact, it's quite the opposite often. So let's use bicycles as an example. We were talking about that earlier.
For sports stuff. My wife's a triathlete and stuff like that, so I get bicycles.
Yeah. So like I love bikes, right? I'm a little bike head. And so we have a 4-person, 23-foot long custom built quad, and it breaks, it breaks out into.
Please tell me you have a picture of that.
Yeah, it breaks out into triplet and a tandem as well. It's all built with S&S couplers. And so you can run it in any configuration. We also have a racing tandem. And so I love bikes, right? Well, as it turns out, the efficient price point on a bike is not the cheapest bike, nowhere close. And yet it's not the most expensive bike. As it turns out, the way bikes are priced, you pay a lot for that last little bit of coolness. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like you can get 80, 90% of all the coolness of a bike for about 50% or 40% of the premium bike.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's kind of, so there's kind of like an efficient price point of getting what you really need and what's really important for a tiny fraction of the price. And it's the same thing in cars, right? Like Iona, the car we bought, staying on track here, was that latest model of Toyota Highlander. They had had a breakthrough in how they designed that Highlander. You see them everywhere right now, at least in my area in Reno, because four-wheel drives are really good for snow country. And so, but I didn't go buy the Lexus, right? Mm-hmm. I bought the Toyota Highlander. But I didn't go buy something, I don't know, like a, I'm not going to name
like
a
Range Rover or something like that.
Well, you know, Range Rovers are funny. When I was trying to find a car for my daughter, Range Rovers on the used market sell for almost nothing.
Interesting.
It's bizarre. They have no resale value. Whereas like a Subaru or a Honda has remarkable resale value. So again, this is getting into the value of the car. What is the intrinsic value of the car? It's telling you something when the resale market is destroyed, right? Whereas if the resale market's super strong on a car, it tells you what the durability and, you know, so the used car market's fairly smart that way. Yeah. And so that can be an indication of where value is.
So that's, it's funny you say that because my wife and I, we have this debate all the time about value. She's really good about certain things. Like her bike she bought, for her last bike she just got rid of, she bought in 2000. And it was a Cannondale. Just got rid of it when we moved here a year ago. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty expensive bike then. She took care of it. Mm-hmm. And it she got her money out of it. Like it was cents on the mile, right? Like it was nothing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Bought a brand new bike, expensive. I mean, it's probably in U.S. dollars, $5,000. But it's going to last her the next probably 10 years. You know, I have a Cannondale I bought 4 years ago that will last me probably another 5 or 10 years.
Where I replace a bike is when there's a technology jump. Like if I had to guess, if it's a road bike, she's got the cool electronic shifting as opposed to the mechanical shifting.
No, she didn't want to get it. She was like, that seems stupid to me. That seems like an extra thing that's going to break down the road. So
could be. I don't know. It's not proven.
Yeah.
Right. But there's I buy them at technology breakthroughs, right? Like mountain bikes have had a technology breakthrough in recent years.
They're amazing.
And they're fundamentally different mountain bike from the mountain bike sitting in my garage. So I'm going to upgrade and get a new one this summer. And so I buy them when there's technology breakthroughs. I don't buy them just to have a cool new bike. So, and then sometimes I like the classic old stuff. Like I've got for a road bike, I've got a 1995 Kestrel that I restored. Right.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely amazing. Like the bike heads know it because it's back in the years when they were handmade. It's the early years of carbon fiber. It was the cutting edge bike and they were hand laid carbon fiber down in Marin before a Japanese company bought them out. Mm-hmm. And so it's absolutely gorgeous. It's like a work of art and I restored it. And that's my road bike. It's my daily rider.
And then
like I had a Trek OCLV. My bikes were Trek OCLV. The first year they came out with that frame design, it was a breakthrough. They still build them to this day. And I had the first year model on both a road bike and a mountain bike. I still have the mountain bike in the garage. That's still my main mountain bike. That's what the one I have to replace. The road bike I actually had to replace. I had so many miles on it that it was insane. That's what I rebuilt the Kestrel to replace it. I mean, I had been through, I don't know how many chains, like 3 wheel sets, several cog sets. I mean, I probably had 50,000 miles on that bike.
That's awesome. So listen, you and I could probably go down a really random rabbit hole since we've talked about fingernails and toenails and bikes and value. What I wanted to quickly do, because I have you for just a few more minutes, is I want to shift kind of back into focus really quick about, first of all, your website, financialmentor.com. You've got this 7 steps to 7 figures course you're working on and you're doing. Can you just kind of explain that quickly to the audience and, what's it about?
Yeah. So I've been coaching people for 2 decades on how to build wealth. And the whole premise was, can I help ordinary people achieve extraordinary financial results? Turns out I could. It took me a while to figure it out. I spent about a decade fumbling around. Then over time, I started seeing the patterns. I started figuring out what were the shortcomings in my coaching that rounded out the curriculum. And eventually it all formed into a 7-step process. And so that's what the 7 steps to 7 figures is, because once I actually really got good at it, then of course, the business took off and it was a time for money business model and I couldn't even service all the clients. So I had to shut it down. Like if you went to my site now, you can't hire me as a financial coach anymore. And so what I'm doing is clients taught me what the 7 steps were And so I just patterned it, built it, designed it, and now I'm converting Todd's knowledge into a box. So I'm putting Todd in a box, if you will, in course format. And the whole premise is it's a scalable business model, and it gives people the knowledge at a much better price point because I'm leveraging technology to deliver the knowledge.
That's awesome. And so, again, you know, for my audience, you can get that at financialmentor.com. That will be in the notes and all that stuff as well.
Yeah. And it's, by the way, it's totally different from like traditional financial planning. Like the step three course is the one that's available now, and it's all about how you design a wealth plan. Don't even confuse it with a traditional financial plan you get from your broker advisor. You know, it involves all three asset classes. It's all built around your personal characteristics, resources, goals. It's totally different from a traditional financial plan.
So, I just got two more questions. And again, I love this interview because I love random interviews, by the way. So for me, this is kind of fun. You know, for someone who is intimidated about even, because, you know, I know you've met these people who it's the thought process of even beginning is what frightens them the most. So what advice do you give these people to even just like come to your website and take the first bite?
Well, I think it's anything. You just have to start somewhere, mm-hmm. right? You either want it or you don't. You know, if you want financial independence, then here's the realization I had when I was a kid. If you want financial independence, you want to be financially free. There's really only one. You have to become an investment expert, right? Because you can delegate authority, but you can't delegate responsibility. Ultimately, you're responsible for your wealth, and you have to have the knowledge at least to know who's good, who isn't, and how to delegate the authority over your money. So even if you don't want to run it yourself, you still have to develop the knowledge, because otherwise you'll make poor decisions. And so you have to become an investment expert, and you have to develop some level of financial expertise. Otherwise, it's just going to cost you dearly. I mean, it's one of the few areas where it's knowledge that pays you, mm-hmm. you know? And so you either want it or you don't. If you want it, then you just start whittling away at it. And here's the remarkable thing, I think, and you'll dig on this idea, is that, you know, anybody can become an expert in anything in just a few years with some diligent effort. You know, just like reading a few articles a night, you know, rather than watch the tube, you can do that. Rather than waste time when you're driving, you could put on a podcast that's on a relevant topic. I mean, you can become a deep subject matter expert in a matter of just, I don't know, 2 to 5 years on any subject. And so if you want it, go get it. If you don't, then you're going to pay the price either way. You either pay the price to get the knowledge or you pay the price for not getting the knowledge, but either way you pay the price. So you just got to decide where you want to land on it. It's your choice.
Well, and it seems like, you know, today more than ever, because I probably should have asked this question way earlier in this process, but like the fact that there's a massive bubble all around. I mean, to me, I'm no financial expert, but just the writing's on the wall that there's going to be a burst somewhere along the way.
Well, what it is let me rephrase it. There's the three major markets are all overvalued, right? Mm-hmm. So let me describe what I mean by that. So you've got the stock market, bond market, and real estate market. And I'm US centric when I'm saying this. Mm-hmm. If you go to world markets, there are world markets that are reasonably valued. For instance, Russia is one of the better valued countries in the world right now. Mm-hmm. So there are major markets that are not radically overvalued, but in US centric terms, which, you know, when the U.S. Coughs, everybody, you know, gets sick, right?
Sure, yeah.
So, because it's just, it's so economically dominant. And so, you know, all the major markets are overvalued, real estate, stocks and bonds, record valuations on every front. So that's kind of what you're referring to. We finally have animal spirits. This is the thing I was looking for. Overvaluation is one thing, but most bubbles end up with animal spirits, right? Where things just go nuts. Like in the internet boom, it was the whole dot-com bubble, right? Mm-hmm. And internet stocks running, that was it. Or at the 2007 top, it was real estate. Real estate was the animal spirits. Well, we were missing the animal spirits until Bitcoin, right? The whole cryptocurrency thing became the bubble du jour. And that's a really fascinating and particularly perplexing and bothersome topic, because I'm going to throw out one other thing. There's one market that is not overvalued. As a matter of fact, it's a historic low valuations relative to all other markets, and that's commodities. And so you've got commodities at record low valuations relative to other markets. You've got all the three major markets all overvalued. Commodities have almost been ignored. And then you've got the bubble du jour and what we'll call the anti-government currency, which is cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. That combination you know, again, the settled knowledge behind that is probably not coming through in the way I'm explaining it, but that begs for like a currency crisis. Because currency crisis could tie in with, you know, inflation, with commodities having a run relative to stocks and bonds and real estate. You know, like, it's just the setup is not looking healthy and particularly bothersome on a longer term basis. And when I say longer term, I'm talking 7 to 15 years. And so I'm quite concerned. Like in the prior bubbles, I wasn't even concerned. You know, because they were solvable and I felt like they would represent opportunity for value buying opportunities. This one bothers me. I don't like the fact that we have three major markets, all three major markets overvalued at the same time. We haven't had that before. And I don't like how cryptocurrencies have captured the public's attention and created an absolutely mind-blowing bubble. I mean, you think about it, they defy every principle of a valid currency because anybody can create one. Yeah. I mean, everybody's got their new coin. I've got a post coming out. I'm going to talk about the new Mentor coin that I'm putting out. Right. And, you know, just as a joke, right. And I'm going to say that it's extremely, you know, all the stuff, all the nonsense that everybody talks about with cryptocurrency to show that it show its value, but they're missing a fundamental point. When there's thousands of cryptocurrency and thousands more on the way, when everybody can produce a currency, what is the value?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, why is Bitcoin 25,000? Like, that's what I don't understand is, what are you buying there? Like, it doesn't even make sense to me.
I have no answer for you. There is none.
Yeah.
Right? The whole premise of its value is that it's limited, but it's not limited because everybody else is coming out with another coin.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no limit, right? There is no boundary on it. And here's the funny thing. If these guys in cryptocurrency market think the government's going to sit around and let them issue currency without the government, the government's going to give up its control over currency, which it needs for its, you know, the government absolutely has to keep control over currency.
Totally.
If they think they're just going to roll over and let this thing go, it is delusional. I think Warren Buffett said, had a really wise statement. He said, I will not get in the front of this bubble at all because you have no idea. Once a bubble goes asymptotic, you know, like it approaches the asymptotic, it goes a vertical climb,
okay,
right? Which is what Bitcoin did. Once it goes asymptotic, there's no knowing how high is high, right? Because once valuations make no sense, it can go double no sense, it can go triple no sense, it still makes no sense,
mm-hmm,
right? In other words, once you've rationalized something that has no logic, it can go beyond craziness. But what he said was really wise. He said, but if I could get a put on it for 5 years out, I would do it. Mm-hmm. In other words, you don't know how high is going to go high. You don't know how far all this nuttiness is going to go, but you do know the ultimate resolution, right? But here's the one thing I want to give as a caveat, okay? The blockchain is a big deal. Okay, so the blockchain, on which is what these cryptocurrencies stand on. I think the cryptocurrency market, I'm not really interested in. It worries me almost as a distraction for the bigger problems we all face when I talk about overvaluation, all the markets and everything. It's almost like this bizarre sideline distraction that's captured everybody's attention. The blockchain itself is going to be hugely valuable and hugely important. You know, the corollary which really holds is the internet bubble back at 2000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the internet absolutely lived up to the dream, but those internet stocks did not.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, so the internet was life-changing. It's changed all our lives. It's fulfilled all the proclamations that were floating around in the late 1990s, right? All the beliefs about how it was going to revolutionize the world. It absolutely did. And the blockchain's the same way. The blockchain absolutely will change things, okay, in a huge way, ways we can't even imagine, just as the internet did. But I have a feeling cryptocurrencies are going to go the way that a lot of the dot-com stocks did. And so people need to be careful, but that doesn't mean they can't go a lot higher. I have no ability to say when this nuttiness ends.
You can't buy into most of them though at this point. I mean, I guess Bitcoin, you can buy in like percentage of cents. I don't know. I don't know how it works, but listen, I got to wrap this and I don't want to, but I need to wrap it. So I need to ask you my final question that I ask everybody. And I gotta say, Todd, I really enjoyed this conversation, but for you, where you're at, what you do, how do you define happiness?
You know, that is a really tough question to end on. So I'm going to go roundabout on it to show I'm not being evasive. Okay. This is an interesting thing. When I sought financial independence, I thought happiness was the endless vacation of life, right? Cause that I was always happy on vacation back when I was a workaholic. And so once I became financially independent, you know, within a couple months of leading what I called the pro leisure circuit, I realized that wasn't happiness. That took me down a path of personal growth where I started realizing there's a lot that goes into happiness. It's very nuanced. You know, there's a lot of things behind what is a fulfilling life. You know, you have to, there's creative pursuits. They have to honor your values. There's community, there's connection, there's sense of purpose. There's a lot of stuff that goes behind just being happy. So, you know, if I had it all mastered and I could give it in a soundbite, you could call me Buddha. I'm not there yet.
Yeah, but it sounds like to me, if I was to paraphrase what you're saying, it's really living life with purpose. Everything else is second nature. Like whatever your purpose is, that's what drives you and makes you happy.
Yeah, but you know, you could be living a life of purpose and your health is gone, or it's purposeful, but it's, I don't know. They're like it's really not that quite that simple. I keep finding like fragments of what's in this happiness equation, and they're all like required. The way I like to say it, happiness is like a cat. Okay.
Didn't we start this conversation off with a cat reference? Go ahead. Finish it off.
All right. So happiness is like a cat, right? Like if you want a cat to come over and lay on your lap, there's a couple ways you could approach it. You can go over, pick up the cat, set it on your lap. And what's the cat going to do? It's going to stand up and walk away, right? It's offended at your repugnance to go grab it, you know, like that, right? Because that's the nature of a cat, right? Yeah. But if you want the cat to come down, what you have to do is you have to create an inviting lap, right? And then you can't get rid of that damn cat if you tried, okay? And so that's the nature of happiness. You have to set up the context from which happiness can exist. You can't overtly go create it. Yeah. You have to go invite it in by leading a life that invites it. I think that's as close as I'm going to get to it.
That's awesome. So, Todd, and I'm going to pause here on that. I'll make sure I say your last name right. Is it Tresider? Tresider?
You can leave it in the recording. Tresider.
Tresider. All right. So, Todd Tresider, thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Hey, James, thanks for having me on the show. I enjoyed talking with you.
Same. Have a great day.
All right, you too.